Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the relationships between human history and human biological development? As our distant ancestors developed bodies that walked on two legs, ate a wide variety of plants and animals, and were guided by large and powerful brains, we also experienced cultural changes that affected how we interact with the world around us. Those changes brought great benefits, but they have also set up some troubling conditions that make us more dependent, say, on medicine to cure our ailments than on environments that help our bodies stay strong and healthy naturally. Daniel E. Lieberman joins us to explain. He is chair of the Department of Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University and author of the new book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. Dan, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with this. This has been debated, but your sense is that we humans are, in fact, still evolving.
Of course. evolution is just a process that is ongoing all the time. You can't halt it any more than you can halt gravity or the electromagnetic force. It's just relentlessly ticking on day by day, year by year, generation by generation. But that said, it's not happening as probably rapidly as it perhaps in the past because of cultural evolution.
Mm-hmm. Part of which is the fact that we have things like medicine, and of course we can supplement our diets with things that we farm and these days buy to eat.
Yeah, I mean, let's go back to your question, because I don't think I answered it quite right, in that, you know, natural selection, evolution by natural selection, is just the combination of three things. It's the existence of variation, some of which is heritable, so it's genetic. And then finally, differential reproductive success. Some people have more children than others. And when you have those three conditions, and some people have more children than others because of heritable variations, then they pass those genes on differentially to the next generation. And so that's going on. But what determines differential reproductive success, as your second question just reminded us, is partly your environment. And when you have medicine and refrigerators and surgery and sanitation, the conditions for which can, say, determine whether you pass on or don't pass on genes to the next generation get less determined by your genetic heritage and more by your, say, cultural environment.
So you catalog a surprising range of modern health problems that could be attributed to a mismatch between the evolutionary state of our bodies and the environments that we've built for ourselves. What do you mean, first of all, by mismatch?
Well, great question. So a mismatch disease, which is not a term that I invented, is simply the idea that some of the adaptations in our bodies, some of the features of our bodies evolved for conditions that are very different from the ones that we live in today. And render us imperfectly or inadequately adapted to the environments we now live in. So an example might be that we evolved to crave sugar. That used to be a very beneficial thing. But today in an environment where we have sugar galore and it's incredibly inexpensive, that same adaptation can get us into trouble. And that leads us to, for example, diseases such as type 2 diabetes and obesity and so on. So there's a long list of diseases. In fact, one could argue that most of the diseases that we suffer from today, the ones that cause us to get sick and that cause us to actually die, are mismatch diseases.
Unfortunately, many of those mismatch diseases, they would not be affected necessarily by the process of natural selection because they don't necessarily have anything to do with our ability to reproduce or how attractive we are to mates.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes them so insidious. So for example, let's take heart disease, which used to be much more rare, but it's become much more common today because of a combination of diet and physical activity, but also stress as well. And so rates of heart disease are just much higher than they ever were in the past. And they're climbing in the developed world. So, for example, in China and India, which is going through a sort of an industrial revolution right now, the rates of heart disease, for example, are skyrocketing in those countries to levels that we see here in the United States. And the problem with those diseases from a selective perspective is that they tend not to affect us until we get to be grandparents, essentially. So people don't get serious hardening of the arteries and heart attacks and strokes until long after not only they reproduce, but even after their children have reproduced. And so we never evolved adaptations to protect us from those diseases because, A, in the past they used to be rare, and, B, if they did exist, they probably didn't have that much effect on people's ability to pass on their genes to the next generation, which is really the only cold calculus that natural selection really cares about.
I loved thinking about this question that you posed in the book because it had not occurred to me before, and that is, what kinds of activities are human bodies evolved for? Deceptively simple question.
Yeah, I mean, we think our lives are normal, right? Today I got up and, and got out of my soft, comfortable bed and sat in a chair while I did my email and went for a run and then sat in a chair for the rest of the day. And I'm sitting in a chair right now. And actually, pretty much all of that's abnormal. And our ancestors, if they slept on a bed, it was a very hard bed without a mattress. They certainly never sat on chairs that had backs on them. I took an elevator to get to the studio, and that didn't exist back then. The way we use our bodies almost the entire day is really bizarre and abnormal from an evolutionary perspective.
My nephew came over the weekend, and he's one. And so, of course, he's sitting not so much in chairs. And when he was sitting on the floor, his posture was amazing. And it occurred to me that he just hasn't learned yet to slump in a chair the way the rest of us do.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that, we all inherited bodies that are very well adapted to a wide variety of circumstances. But we also have we've also all inherited a tendency to love and crave comfort. And I like sitting in chairs. I'm not one of those people I do have a standing desk, which I don't use all the time. But we like comfort because comfort makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. It means you're not spending energy that you would otherwise have to spend. So we're also all, naturally adapted, to living very different lives than the ones we do. It just so happens that we grew up in a time and a place that has given us all these marvelous comforts, which have many benefits, but they also have some costs.
And we don't automatically realize that just because it feels good doesn't mean it's good for us.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Most people think that comfort is intrinsically good for you. After all, it's
like
comfortable.
It. Right.
Yeah. So we like comfortable shoes. We like comfortable chairs. We like comfortable mattresses. But from an evolutionary perspective, that doesn't. You can understand why maybe comfort was selected for the desire to seek comfort because it was actually very rare. But from a health perspective, comfort isn't necessarily good for us. So people who sleep in very soft mattresses have a higher percentage of back pain. People who sit in chairs all day long suffer from a wide range of problems, from short flexing of their hips and weak backs, etc. So shoes, for example, may cause our feet to be weaker than they otherwise would be if we went barefoot, causing more people to have flat feet and other foot problems. We pay for comfort just as much as we benefit from comfort.
So I wear eyeglasses, as I see you do from your promotional photograph, it's no big deal. You put them on every day. You can see clearly and go about your day. But it's occurred to me in the past, I'm so glad I live now and not 5,000 years ago because I can get my eyes easily corrected. But you're saying that I might not have been nearsighted if I had lived 5,000 years ago.
Isn't that fascinating?
So, yeah.
So this is a real surprise to a lot of folks. But, we actually have pretty good data that until recently, myopia, being nearsighted, was incredibly rare. The very first time it was, there are a few ancients, who are well known to have been myopic, usually learned men who read books a lot. But it was extremely rare among the peasantry as well as even the aristocracy of most countries. Until really the Industrial Revolution, when universal literacy started becoming, nearly universal. And the first person to notice it was actually the surgeon, the doctor to the Queen's Guard. Those guards who wear those silly poofy hats in front of Buckingham Palace, right? He noticed that the officers had a high percentage of myopia. Many of them were nearsighted. But among the the poor fellows who were actually out there in the rain and the wind all the time guarding the queen, that none of them were myopic, or almost none of them were myopic. Mm. And so he wrote a famous paper back in the early 19th century documenting this. And then quickly people around the world started checking to see if that was also true in Denmark and Germany, etc. We also know from studies of hunter-gatherers that hunter-gatherers until recently also didn't have myopia. And it's really a result of, like all diseases, a gene-environment interaction. So there are some people who have genes that make them more likely to be nearsighted than others. But what triggers that to turn into myopia is actually changes in our environment. So it's a combination of close work, so looking at things up close all the time, which causes changes in your eyes as they develop, but also looking at visual fields, what you look at, if it's very unstimulating, that can also affect how the eyeball grows. Mm-hmm. So being inside, for example, regardless of how much you read, is strongly correlated with a tendency towards developing myopia. So until recently, it was basically not a problem. Nobody got it, or almost nobody got it, and chances are you wouldn't have either.
Hmm. But then I would have had to live outside all the time, right?
Well, I mean, that can have its benefits.
It can. So take us through like a day in the life of hunter-gatherer peoples, how they got their food, what that really took, and what they were eating.
Well, that's a great question because, you know, we have this idea that there is a kind of a hunter-gatherer way of life. In fact, that's in some ways the idea behind the paleo diet craze. And I think one of the interesting things you learn about studying human evolution is that there really was no one hunter-gatherer way of life. Hunter-gatherers varied as much as people vary today. They lived in tropical environments that were very moist and tropical environments that were humid. They lived in the Arctic. They lived in the desert. They, you know, there's just a wide range of habitats and a wide range of foods that they ate, which makes it very hard to come up with a single characterization of hunter-gatherer lifestyle, even hunter-gatherer diets. But if you were to kind of take off your glasses, so everything's a little bit blurry, and try to make some generalizations, the most important ones are that they lived in small groups. They tended to be, you know, 25 to 50 individuals. They tended to be fairly active, but not ridiculously active. So they were, you know, they would spend, 4 to 6 hours a day doing work, but not all of it very strenuous. They socialize a lot. They of course every day gather and hunt all the food that they're going to eat. Depending upon where they live, they would gather more or hunt more. They tend to cook their food and prepare it just as we do. They tend to migrate from habitat to habitat throughout the year, so they tend to move on average about 6 or 7 times a year. Compared to our lives today, I think what matters most is that they don't eat processed diets at all. So they get almost no sugar. They get lots of fiber. They get actually similar amounts of fat and protein and carbohydrates, but the carbohydrates they ate were much more complex, so they rarely got simple carbohydrates. And they probably had a lot less stress because even though they can have tough times, there's usually food for them. It's really with the origins of farming that we get lots of diseases that we get from animals. We get diseases that come from our diets. Life really took a turn for the worse, actually, with agriculture.
We'll talk about that in just a minute with Daniel E. Lieberman, chair of the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University and author of The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the chair of the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard, Daniel E. Lieberman. His latest book is called The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. And Dan, before the break, you were telling us that things all went downhill when we learned how to farm, how to cultivate our own food. This is probably surprising to people who think that everything got easier when we were able to sort of count on our own ability to produce what we needed.
Well, like everything, there's trade-offs. It's a mixed bag, right? So the advantages of farming, of course, are that you can have more food. And farmers have more children, and they can live in larger towns, and they can be sedentary and, not have to move around, and they can have stuff, possessions, and they can, begin to diversify and have artists and lawyers. Well, you might not think that's a good thing. But, farming brought many benefits. There's no question about it. But with those benefits also came some costs. Probably the most serious costs were disease, because hunter-gatherers just live at very low population densities so that there's really no chance for infectious diseases to move throughout populations. So think of the Ebola virus. I mean, that just wouldn't happen among hunter-gatherers. In addition, farmers live with their animals, and we get lots of diseases from our animals. In fact, most of the scary diseases that we get, that we're still worried about, came from animals. Farming brought violence and hierarchies and, lawyers, right? And then finally, farming brought changes to our diet. And although we have a lot more calories because of farmed food, the quality of the foods that we eat in terms of nutrition is actually lower. So malnutrition actually went up. Diseases of like vitamin diseases, deficiencies also became much more prevalent. So it turns out that after farming, you just look at the evidence that people became shorter, their lifespans declined, their infant mortality rates remained extremely high, and they also suffered from famines and plagues and things like that hunter-gatherers just never had. And it wasn't really until the invention of modern medicine and sanitation that we really crawled our way out of many of the sort of problems that were caused by farming.
So hunter-gatherers needed to be able to recognize hazards in the environment. They needed that fight-or-flight response. What's the difference between the kind of stress many of us deal with on a regular basis in modern life and the kind of stress we are evolved for?
That's a great question, because it's really at the heart of a lot of problems that we face. So stress is adaptive, right? If a lion is chasing you, or you think a lion might chase you, it's a good idea to get your heart rate up and run as fast as you can. Or if you see a snake or something like that. But those kinds of stress events tend to be short-lived. They tend to be short in duration but intense. And that's good. The kinds of stress that we now encounter are chronic, and that really yields just lays waste to our system, our bodies in many ways. For one, it elevates cortisol levels, right? So you have cortisol. Cortisol is a hormone that it's secreted from a gland on top of your kidney, and when you release cortisol, it's basically designed to get energy to you right there and right then. And that's very useful for moments of stress. But if you're in a constant state of stress, it causes us to have high levels of blood sugar. It causes us to depress our immune systems. It causes us to sleep less, which then causes us to be stressed more. It changes our fat distribution. So high levels of cortisol cause us to redistribute fat from harmless places like in our thighs or buttocks, etc., to places where it's very harmful, like around in our belly. So what's called visceral fat or belly fat is actually the fat that causes most of the diseases that we care about today. And stress levels basically transfer fat to those areas. For a short term, that's a good thing. Over long, hours, years, months of stress, that's a ruinous thing. And so many of the problems that we face today come from chronic stress.
So, Dan, I think these days most people believe that it's true that you have to use it or lose it when it comes to keeping your body in shape, keeping your cognitive function strong, but we still don't like it. Why are we evolved to use it or lose it?
Well, that's because, you know, we never evolved not to use it. So and there's lots of fascinating adaptations our bodies have to adjust capacity to demand. So so take, for example, muscle, right? So muscle is about, on an average human being, about 40% of his or her body weight. And it's pretty expensive. It costs a lot of energy to maintain and use that muscle. So if you don't really want to have more muscle than you need, if you really bulk up like Arnold Schwarzenegger, well, in the old days, right? That's a very, I mean, if you ever seen pictures of him eating when he was, you know, a weightlifter, you know, he was eating constantly because he had to eat enormous amounts in order to pay for that very expensive tissue. So we evolved. Lots of our body systems are like muscle in the sense that we want to have enough for basic capacity, but we don't have more than it's necessary because that costs us. And so that's true of our bones. It's true of our muscles. It's true of our immune systems. It's true of pretty much most of the systems of our bodies, which is why when we don't use them, we get into trouble because we never actually evolved to be couch potatoes. So there never was any adaptation to not using your bones, not using your skeleton, not using your muscles, not using your immune system. And so when we sort of remove the sort of normal levels of use, our bodies just don't know what to do. And the result is, for example, let's take the case of osteoporosis. You need to have a certain amount of exercise, of strain, deformation of your bones for them to grow properly. And if you don't use your bones enough when you're young, you don't grow thick enough bones that can withstand the inevitable declines in bone mass that occur as we age. So more people are falling below that threshold that causes osteoporosis simply because we never evolved to handle physical inactivity in our lives. And also, as you mentioned earlier, you know, people who get osteoporosis tend not to get it until their grandparents. And so it really is silent to the effects of natural selection.
You never go outside and see like an obese raccoon or squirrel. So I'm wondering, do human beings really, I mean, do we store fat more easily than other animals, or do we just have vastly more food available to us than animals in the wild do and then humans in the wild did, you know, tens of thousands of years ago?
That's another wonderful question. So it turns out that, well, lots of animals can get fat. And if you go to zoos, it's not hard to find obese.
But they're like us, right? They're kind of like living the life in captivity.
Exactly. They're lounging around in their lazy boys and sipping big gulps. But the humans are so again, so all other animals also have the proclivity to add on fat. But there's a lot of evidence that we are especially inclined to do so. A typical primate, adult primate, is about 5% body fat. In fact, their children are born about 3% body fat, you know, little baby primates. Human babies are born about 15% body fat. And we actually go up to about 25% body fat. That's a healthy level for after about a year of life. And then we decline. So typical hunter-gatherer males will be 10 to 15% body fat and females 20, 25% body fat. Obviously, a lot of Americans today are way above those levels. So the average skinny, thin hunter-gatherer is really fat compared to most primates and actually compared to most mammals. We are a fat species, even in our thinnest state. And we really crave foods that help us become fat or store fat because fat is really important in our evolutionary history. There's two main reasons. One is that our brains are very big, and brains are very expensive, and you have to pay for them constantly, and they can't store energy. So you always have to have a lot of energy on board to keep paying for that brain, especially when you're a child. You know, a child, an infant, is half of its metabolism is just going towards paying for its brain. And then the other reason we need fat is that mothers need to nurse their offspring and then also help feed children and you know, mothers need to provide a lot of calories to their offspring, and they need to do so even when they're in what we call negative energy balance, even if they're not collecting as much energy as they're using, and they have to be able to do that for days, weeks, sometimes even months, be in what we call negative energy balance in order to not lose their offspring. And so humans evolved to have a special reservoir of fat that other animals don't have, especially human females. And you know, normal amounts of fat are fine, and in fact, most kinds of fat are actually very healthy. The fats that really kill us are the ones that are, again, in our belly, the visceral fats. Those are the ones for which we're really paying a really substantial price now. in terms of our health.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phone now and speak with Francisco in Dallas. Hi, Francisco.
Hi there. Very interesting discussion. Thank you. Professor Lieberman, I just wonder what your thoughts are, and I realize this is a little bit outside your area of study, but I'm curious about what your thoughts are about the history of human sexuality, and maybe if you could even comment on its future, if you know what that's about, because based on what you're talking about hunter-gatherers, I gather from that, you know, child-rearing was an important part of that. Now we have, you know, a society that doesn't necessarily focus on children as much as, you know, relationships, and we have condoms and, you know, contraceptive ways to sort of avoid having children. Do you see that as sort of changing the way our bodies are developing in terms of evolution?
Well, you're right that it's not my specialty, so I'm going to punt slightly, but you raise a fascinating point. And there is evidence, of course, that the ways in which way human sexuality is changing is indeed affecting our health from a fascinating evolutionary perspective. And one of them would be a subject you mentioned, which is contraception. So your typical hunter-gatherer will go through about 150 menstrual cycles in the course of her entire life. And that's because, first of all, they're natural fertility populations. They don't have contraception. Also, they tend to go through a few cycles. Then they get pregnant. And then they nurse their offspring for a while. And then they go through a fair number of cycles before they have the energy levels to again become pregnant again. But that's several times less cycles than a typical American female will go through, who will go through maybe 400 to 500 cycles in her life. And each one of those cycles involves huge swings of hormones, estrogen, progesterone, that are, of course, very important for preparing the body for becoming pregnant and for nurturing an embryo. But they also increase the risk of breast cancer and some other reproductive cancers. So one of the trade-offs that we have for because of modern cultural evolution and our ability to practice contraception is an increase in rates of breast cancer among women today, which is again part of that trade-off. I'm not arguing that we shouldn't. That's a good trade-off or a bad trade-off. That's a complex discussion, but it is a result of this. Of this mismatch between what our bodies evolved for and what we're now experiencing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's take another call now. We have Paul on the line in Southlake. Hey, Paul.
Hi. My question is, it seems to me that when I hear about the evolution, it's kind of like a look at the past and, you know, the iterations and a lot of that happened with us, with human beings in the past, to explain the present. And I'm just kind of wondering, can you use the same kind of, can you then project into the future about what evolution is going to cause to happen and then do things to prevent some of these things from happening in the future? For example, can we see the evolution of a certain disease, and can we do something now that will help us to prevent?
What do you think, Dan?
Well, that's a terrific question, Paul. Thank you for asking it. I mean, on the one hand, evolution is not a predictive science. That's what many people would say. And that I can't tell you what humans are going to look like 10, 20, 30, 100 generations from now, although maybe the movie WALL-E is a bad prediction. But we do understand the processes by which evolution occur, and they can help us evaluate some of the probabilities. And I think the one case for which we have the best information is indeed what you mentioned, which is infectious disease. So we know that, for example, if you create it's the real concern, for example, about overuse of antibiotics, right? We know that if you overuse antibiotics, create heavy use of antibiotics among, say, animals or even among humans, you create the evolutionary conditions that increase the probability that bacteria that are resistant to those antibiotics will evolve. They just, because variation occurs with every generation, and bacteria every generation is, you know, a blink of an eye. And they reproduce rapidly, and so you just have a high rate of change. So you have a higher rate of probability that you're creating conditions for antibiotic resistant diseases. So I think those are the most common predictions. You can also make some predictions about, for example, population size and population density and the rates at which diseases such as Ebola will sweep through a population. So yes, there are particular examples of evolutionary processes that we can use to make some predictions. But for the most part, it's a very difficult task. But what we can do is we can make some predictions also about the mismatch between cultural evolution and biological evolution, because we know that biological evolution in our bodies, for example, is going to keep ticking on at a fairly constant rate. I mean, larger populations mean there are more mutations that are available. But we do also know is that that cultural evolution is occurring at an ever-accelerating pace. I mean, just think about the changes that have occurred in just the last generation or two. I mean, they're mind-boggling. And we know that those changes are going to continue to accelerate. And that leads to the prediction that mismatch diseases will also continue to accelerate as our bodies and our cultures become less and less in sync.
So what do we do to, it's certainly easier to change our culture than it is to change evolution, although neither one is simple. What do we do to nudge ourselves in the direction of something that's good for us?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that evolution does help us evaluate, you know, the costs and benefits. I'm certainly not one of these, you know, Luddites who thinks that we should, abandon civilization and, you know, throw away our shoes and never take antibiotics and, you know, only eat a paleo diet. That's not only silly, it would also cause much of the world to be in misery or die. But we can learn from our evolutionary past and be more intelligent about how we use culture. And I think that one perfect example is sugar, right? I mean, it's no secret. There's been a huge debate and discussion that, you know, unprocessed, you know, highly processed foods that are rich in sugar and simple carbohydrates are making our children fat and making us sick and giving all kinds of diseases. That's information we can use now to help each other control and contain our urges. So, and an evolutionary perspective helps us understand how to make the right kinds of choices.
We're speaking with Daniel E. Lieberman about his new book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking with Daniel E. Lieberman, chair of the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard and author of The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Dan, we developed agriculture. We started to live in closer proximity to animals, certainly with larger human population densities. Disease, infectious disease, was one of the consequences. And so as time went on, we learned to be a little cleaner, to have better hygiene. And then we got really sterile as things happened. And now we have all these problems with things like asthma and allergies and autoimmune disorders. What's going on?
It's a fascinating example of how evolution still really matters. You and I have immune systems that we inherited from our parents, who inherited from their parents, etc. And those immune systems evolved for conditions that are really profoundly different from the ones that we encounter today. They're involved for dealing with a lot of basically germs and worms that used to be in our environment. I mean, your typical human being for most of human evolutionary history had a healthy dose of worms living in his or her gut and had to eat filthy things from the cave floor, et cetera. And our immune systems had to kind of work to kind of take care of all that and keep us healthy. Now we live in these wonderfully sterile environments, right? I mean, my kitchen, we keep it very clean. And you know, if something falls on the kitchen floor, we throw it away. And I hopefully don't have worms in my gut. But we pay a price for that because my immune system is still there, right? It's still waiting. It's sort of evolved and primed and ready to take care of all those, infections. And now it's got nothing to do. And the analogy I often use is a bit like teenagers who are bored on street corners without anything to do. They're more likely to get into trouble, right? And the same thing is true of our immune system. They're more likely now because of this absence of what some people call old friends in a kind of sarcastic way. They're more likely to start taking miscues and suddenly becoming deciding that peanuts are the enemy, or the cells that line our intestine, which give us things like Crohn's disease and irritable bowel syndrome. So we have immune systems that, in a sense, are paying for some of the improvements in sanitation that have yielded some benefits, but also for which we are now paying some costs.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Dewey on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Dewey.
Hello. Yes, I have a question. Guested a while ago, it's something in fact that we do have more heart problems now. I'd like to know if factors more prevalence of cancer, putting aside that we can find it with the test easier, but is there actually more prevalence of cancers?
That's a fantastic question. Thanks for asking it. So it's hard to diagnose cancer, of course, in the past because the diagnostic techniques, as you just mentioned, were less sophisticated. But we do know that people did get cancer in the past. And in fact, we even know that dinosaurs got cancer. So cancer is not a completely new disease. But the evidence is very strong that cancer rates are rising. And in fact, they're rising so fast, we can see them rising throughout the developed world. For example, people who grew up in developing countries like India who move to developed countries like the United States or England are much more likely to develop cancers than their siblings who remain, say, in India or Bangladesh or wherever the population may come from. And that comes from a variety of factors, and one of them is energy. You have so much energy your body can use, right? So you can use it to grow. You can use it to maintain yourself. Or you can use it to reproduce. And in the old days, when energy was very limited, any little extra energy that you had, you would want to put towards reproduction because that's what natural selection cares about, right? Survival of the fittest. And fittest means, in that case, having more offspring than somebody else. So now what happens is that we have all this extra energy. You can only grow so much. You can only maintain your body so much. But we still, it's this natural tendency for your body to shunt that energy towards reproductive tissues. And the result is that you get higher rates, for example, of breast cancer or testicular cancer, prostate cancer in developed countries when people have essentially better hygiene, more energy. They also have higher rates of cancer. Cancers, of course, are also on the rise because of pollutants and other shifts in our environment. And so, yes, some cancers, not all cancers, but some cancers are mismatch diseases. Another example would be living longer. I mean, you're more likely to get cancer if you live to be older, and people are living longer, and so that gives them more probability, a higher probability that as they age, they can accumulate mutations that lead to cancer. So cancers are a consequence of the interaction between our evolved biology and the environments in which we now live.
So, Dan, I read your book last week, which is to say too late to save me the huge amounts of money that I've spent straightening my children's teeth. But this is another problem that, as it turns out, maybe they wouldn't have been, grown up with jack-o'-lantern teeth had they lived a long time ago.
Yeah, well, it turns out that if you eat very hard, mechanically demanding diets, those kind of forces from chewing hard food and tough food kind of push your teeth into the right place, which is basically what orthodontists do when you put braces on a kid. They're using mechanical forces to push the teeth into the places that they ought to be. But if you go into the museum collections of most museums that have very old skulls and skeletons, you'll see that people's teeth came in very straight in the old days. But now we grind up our food and we process it and we change it in all kinds of ways, which is nice. And I love pureed soups as much as the next guy, and shakes and smoothies and all that. But we have a very abnormal amount of chewing that we do today, and the result is yet another mismatch disease, which is an increase in malocclusions and teeth coming in crooked, and we also have more cavities. But again, we have to ask ourselves, are the costs worth the benefits worth the costs? And in some cases, I think the answer is quite yes. I mean, I think, most people would say that reading and you know, spending time indoors, you know, learning in school and all that is worth the increased risk of myopia. Maybe eating well-cooked food might be worth the trouble that you have taking your kids to the orthodontist. So I do think that maybe gum is probably an underrated preventative technique that hasn't been explored enough. But in other cases, of course, I think we would agree that the benefits don't outweigh the costs. And certainly heart disease and type 2 diabetes and cancers, et cetera, are the ones that leap to mind. They're the ones that are most likely to kill us. They're the ones that cost us, you know, billions, if not trillions of dollars in medical fees. It's causing a lot of misery. We really need to find a way out of some of these solutions, and I don't think we're going to do that without having some consideration of evolution.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Melissa in Fort Worth. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. This is a really interesting discussion. My question is about reproductive issues. I am 28, and my daughter is 5 months old, and we had two miscarriages before her. And it just seems like so many people of my generation are having to resort to other medical interventions in order to get pregnant. And I'm just wondering if that's evolutionary because of maybe all the chemicals and extra things that are in our diets, or if it actually has always been this prevalent. And because of maybe Twitter and Facebook, our generation is more open to talk about things like that.
That's a really interesting question. And I don't know the answer to that because I don't think there's a lot of good data on fertility rates in enough subsistence level populations. There certainly is evidence, for example, in Africa, it's called the infertility belt, that there are areas where you know, fertility rates are lower than other parts of the world because of issues such as the energy available to mothers, because of infectious diseases, because of certain, you know, that interact with certain genetic backgrounds. So certainly that is, this is not a new problem, but the extent to which it's become more common today because of mismatches and cultural changes is a really interesting one. And I just don't know enough to comment accurately enough to answer your question. But it's a great question.
Let's take another question. This one is from Christina in Plano. Hi, Christina.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And my question is, you're familiar with the teachings of Dr. Weston Price?
Of course.
Oh, okay. And his studies of indigenous cultures and their great teeth, and there was a lot of a movement, the Weston Price movement. And I was just wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, Weston Price was really one of the real sort of first people to think about this issue. That he traveled around the world and showed that among other things, teeth and were you know, much healthier in subsistence populations than in industrial or agricultural populations, and made the argument that that, you know, pointed out that changes to diet and nutrition have indeed had, you know, causing what he didn't use the term, but he would have today called them mismatched diseases. So absolutely, he was a pioneer in this field. And really began to open people's eyes. And of course, when he was publishing that work back in the 20s, I believe it was, that you know, that was very novel and controversial. For example, people in very hunter gatherers, for example, didn't have cavities. We now know he was to a large extent correct.
What do we know about public policy or other rules or measures that can be put in place that make it a little bit easier for people to make good choices? And I'm thinking even about the way we've cut down on smoking, because it is socially unacceptable to smoke in many places where it used to not be questioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the key point to understand is that, you know, we are asking people today to make choices that we didn't really evolve to make. That we are now confronted with, you know, a world full of cheap processed food that's tasty and calorific and desirable, that's actually unhealthy, where we have we filled our world with escalators and elevators and shopping carts and all sorts of things that make our lives more easy but actually don't necessarily benefit us. And we have to understand that we have to find some balance between giving people choice, because I do believe people have the right to, you know, if they want to, just as much as they want to smoke or drink soda or whatever, that's fine. But we should also help them make the decisions that they would like to make in their own self-best interest. And that means that we have to have government involved and we have to act collectively. So we need to have, for example, more physical education, because kids like to run around, but you often have to get them outside in order to do so. Adults also need to run around a fair amount, and we need to help them have the time and incentive and the wherewithal to do it. A lot of environments a lot of suburbs, for example, don't even have sidewalks, so people even can't walk to the local grocery store. They're forced to drive. We need to help nudge ourselves to eat the foods that we would like to eat. We also have to help ourselves not be nudged by those who want to try to nudge us in the other direction. So there's no way for us to get out of this without some collective involvement, because we're all in this together. Whether you like it or not, all that cheap sugar that's filled our food system, we pay for it one way or the other. We either pay for it when we buy the goods that we, you know, everything you pay for, you're paying for not just the product itself, but you're also paying for the health care costs of all that sugar that all the people who made it made them sick. So we need to, I think, rethink how we're going to help each other make the right choices. I don't believe that we should have a nanny state and prevent people from doing unhealthy things. I mean, after all, we all have those rights, but we all need help making the choices that we would like to make, and sometimes we just can't do that. And I think that's where an evolutionary perspective, I think, becomes important.
Should we try to direct the course of our evolution by manipulating our genes, as we're able to do so?
Oy, oy.
I know, and I gave you like 40 seconds to answer this question, so I apologize for that.
I worry about people trying to make those kinds of decisions. The ethical concerns of trying to engineer human beings is very concerning. People wiser than me have a lot of concerns, and I share them. I think we should. I mean, look, the world is tough enough as it is. We need to figure out how to help each other. And there's a lot of things that we can do right here and now, without spending a lot of money, without a lot of technology. I mean, really, if you want to make the world a healthier, happier place, if you could just get people to sleep a little bit more, help them be more physically active, get them to eat less sugar and simple starches, you could. We would transform our landscape. The healthcare crisis that we're currently dealing with would vanish overnight if we could just do those three things.
Daniel E. Lieberman is chair of the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard and author of The Story of the Human Body: Evolution, Health, and Disease. Dan, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.